Significant impacts of the ongoing government shutdown will be felt as soon as this weekend. The recovery from Hurricane Melissa begins in the Caribbean, and a Hollywood movie comes home. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm Carlton Gillespie. Tim Padgett is out this week. In the next hour, we'll discuss how the government shutdown could cause skyrocketing premiums for those who use government-subsidized health care. In Florida, that's nearly 3 million people. And how SNAP running out of funding further compounds the affordability squeeze. We'll also check in on the recovery from Hurricane Melissa, which devastated the Caribbean earlier this week. We'll hear from those mobilizing aid efforts here. And Canvas, a 2006 film set and filmed in Hollywood, comes home this weekend. All that coming up right after the news. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Carlton Gillespie. Tim Padgett is out this week. The ongoing government shutdown has largely hinged on a disagreement over whether or not to extend the enhanced COVID-era tax credits for the Affordable Care Act. But the effects of that shutdown have been largely abstract for many Americans. Yes, hundreds of thousands of government workers have either been furloughed or are working without pay, flights have been delayed, and some nonprofits haven't gotten their grants. But for many Americans, there hasn't been a real, tangible impact. That ends this weekend. Those tax credits expire December 31st, and open enrollment for those who get their health care through the ACA, also known as Obamacare, begins Saturday. This time around, for the roughly 850,000 South Floridians who enroll through the ACA, their premiums are going to be higher. Much higher. 114% higher, according to the nonprofit research organization KFF. Compounding that, funding for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program has run out, according to the USDA, meaning that nearly 3 million Floridians won't get their food stamp funds on November 1st. It's a double whammy, exacerbating an affordability crisis that has many people feeling like 63-year-old Pompano Beach resident Catherine Botello.
I'm really stuck between a rock and a hard place. I've lessened my coverage on my car insurance. I've cut off some streaming services. I'm not going out. I'm watching where I drive because, you know, the price of gas is up. I'm basically just sitting here grateful that I have a roof over my head, but how much longer will I be able to do this?
Are you feeling the squeeze from SNAP benefits or worried about rising premiums for ACA plans? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. To help us understand the state of the shutdown and the impact of these cuts is Congresswoman Sheila Sherfalus McCormick of Florida's 20th District. Congresswoman, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me in covering this important issue.
Also joining us is Scott Darius, the Executive Director of Florida Voices for Health. Scott, welcome to the Roundup.
Hey there, thanks for having me.
Congresswoman, we'll start with you and let's start with SNAP. Can you paint us a picture of how your district, which includes parts of Central Western Broward and parts of Palm Beach County, will feel the impact of these funds running out? What are you hearing from your constituents?
Well, we're getting several calls from many people who have anxiety about waking up tomorrow and facing hunger. In the state of Florida, we have 2.8 million families who would lose food assistance. But in my district, we have 51,000 families who depend on SNAP. These are children, seniors, and people with disabilities. I tell everyone that hunger never takes a day off, even when Washington does and has this fight. It shows up in our children's lunchboxes. It shows up in empty fridges, in the face of parents who are just desperately trying to do their best. And we have to show up for them. Now, there are funding that we could use to cover SNAP for at least for 2 or 3 weeks, which would at least help many families. And that's the Section 32 funding that they could use. So this is avoidable, and we need to see and pressure the administration as much as we can so they can actually prevent this from happening tomorrow morning.
When you mentioned that funding that is in place, that contingency funding that you said is earmarked specifically to fund SNAP during shortfalls like this, but the Trump administration says that those funds in place are actually ineligible to be used to stop these cuts from happening on November 1st. What's their argument as to why, and what's your response?
Well, I don't believe that that's valid. If they wanted to, they could use that funding. And if they wanted to, they can use other funding because we've seen them do that already. The methodology they use to even cover the troops isn't legal, but they went forward with it. So why not take every precaution to make sure that our children, our families are not starving? When it comes to starvation, this is not something we should be willfully going into as a negotiation tool, especially in this economy. I mean, how much more can the American people take? They're already looking at their ACA going up. People are seeing the premium. In my district, we have people going from $500 to $2,500 in premiums, and they can't afford it. In addition to that, we have people also who are Medicaid, who are waiting for their Medicaid to be cut. And now we're feeling the impact of SNAP. If you look at the cumulative effect, so many people will be devastated and looking to eat, looking for somewhere to live. And we just can't afford to keep going down this slippery slope of devastating our most vulnerable.
The Senate has met and failed 13 times to pass a funding resolution that the House passed, and the House hasn't even been in session since the shutdown occurred, and that will likely continue into next week. Do you have any sense of a timeline for the end of this shutdown or for at least negotiations to advance?
Well, I'm hoping that they'll come to an end very quickly. As I was in DC the past 2 days, many Republicans actually discussed and said that they cannot, face their constituents when they know they're starving. This SNAP issue is a huge issue for everybody. Even the ACA credits, if we look at it, there are more Republican states who actually depend on ACA, the healthcare credits, and who also depend on SNAP. So they're going to be feeling it also. And so I think that pressure is really going to make them come to the table. But at the end of the day, I don't think the American people in this economy can stomach more than even 2 days of not having SNAP benefits. I mean, starvation at this moment is just not something that we should be looking at. So I hope and I think that they'll buckle quickly. And we're doing everything to push. We even have some states, some AGs who actually filed a lawsuit. And they're hoping to hear from today if they can prevent any cuts or prevent not funding SNAP for their states. But unfortunately, the state of Florida is not one of those states. But whoever we can prevent, whoever we can help is the goal. I actually met today with a food pantry and also a private partnership with DoorDash, and they're getting prepared to deliver food to those families who actually are on SNAP who won't be receiving their benefits. We also have other groups like Feeding South Florida who are partnering. So we're doing everything to fill in that gap while we're in the shutdown, but it can only hold for so long. And I'm proud of the community and the businesses who are actually Americans stepping in to save Americans, but Congress needs to step in and negotiate and do our job, save American lives, stop this conversation, and not use poor people who need food as pawns.
And you mentioned the negotiation here between expanding these tax credits. I spoke earlier this week to your Democratic colleague, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and she said she wants these tax credits to be made permanent. But is there a number of years that you're comfortable accepting as a compromise to avoid further attrition, be it 10 years, 3 years, 1 year?
But we have to start with it being permanent first, right? That has to be the starting point because we know in a negotiation, if you say we want to start with 1 year or 2 year, good luck if you even get that.
Sure.
And so we have to stick to our guns to make sure that it's permanent. But now, if they want to negotiate to 5 years, we can do that also. But what we can't do is say nothing. What we can't do is stay silent. What we can't do is just pretend like we're not hurting the American people in order to have tax breaks for billionaires.
And you mentioned some of these organizations, Feeding South Florida, the United Way, that have all started bracing themselves for the fallout. But you mentioned that can't hold forever. If both sides aren't negotiating, what can everyday Americans do to keep themselves fed or healthy?
Well, the number one thing we can do is start lifting up our votes, our voices. We've been doing a series of town halls and roundtables all throughout South Florida to get people's attention and let them know, use your power. Your power is going to be when you speak up, when you send emails, when you send text messages. Let your representative know that you are going to suffer and what you're going to suffer from. It's make it real for everyone because unfortunately, some people aren't seeing our faces and aren't in the community, and they're not seeing the starvation on the face of the parents and the children. And so I ask everybody, use your voice, use your power. Let them know that we're not going to stand for this. And the American people have to be put first when we come to making decisions and we come to negotiating. The second thing I would say is look to the resources that we're putting out. We are actively trying to make sure everybody knows where to find food, where to find any kind of help they need. So we're going to continue that. We're going to continue our town halls, meeting with people. We've done over 100 since the year began. And we're going to continue mobilizing just everyone to let them know that, hey, American people matter. No matter if you're poor, disabled, children, we need to put the American people first and not financial interest.
And so people who log on this weekend to enroll in open enrollment for their American Care, their Affordable Care Act plans, like we mentioned, they are going to feel that sticker shock. But if a deal is reached on these tax credits before they expire December 31st, would that be enough to reduce the cost of these premiums for this enrollment period?
I believe so. We'll see the rates go back. That's the hope, that the rates will go back to normal, especially right now when we know we have a bad economy. We've heard this week several companies have been laying off people, and we're feeling that. And so in this moment, having any kind of increase without any kind of substitution or a different program would be just despicable, I believe, because there's so many Americans who have high blood pressure, who have diabetes, and they're taking medication every single day. And right now, they're about to face imagining a world where you can't take your medication, you can't see a doctor, and you know a stroke, a heart attack, all of that is imminent. And to live in that space when you had coverage, and because of this tax break that you're trying to do to put innocent lives of parents, regular individuals in harm, is just not worth it.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Carlton Gillespie. I'm speaking with Congresswoman Sheila Sherfalus McCormick of Florida's 20th District and Scott Darius, Executive Vice President of Florida Voices for Health, about the looming cuts to SNAP and the rising premiums for the Affordable Care Act recipients. Let's stay with the Affordable Care Act half of this conversation and bring in Scott Darius. Scott, we've heard about the economic impact that rising coverage costs can have, including that many Floridians might choose to remain uninsured. But what are the healthcare impacts of someone losing insurance? For instance, those without insurance might be less likely to regularly see their primary care provider.
Yeah, I think what we see now, the challenge with our healthcare system is that it's made up of such a patchwork of programs that you have so many people without coverage. And what we end up doing is paying for care in the most expensive setting possible, which is in emergency rooms. Just if you look at even a small issue, a fraction of the larger issue, right? Dental access, where we currently have 7 million Floridians who live in dental provider shortage areas, and it's just one of the hardest services to get access to, especially if you're low income. But as a state, we spend over $500 million a year on preventable emergency room visits for just dental care. And when you factor in everything else, you realize, yeah, just how many poor outcomes we're encouraging. But then what we pay for that, for such an inefficient system, is, yeah, I think we can do better.
And that's just dental are the numbers you're talking about.
And that's just dental.
So obviously, this rising premiums are going to impact people across the country, but specifically in this state and specifically in South Florida, this will likely be the area maybe hardest hit by these rising premiums. Can you break down why?
Sure. You have about a million people in Miami-Dade alone who are signed up through the ACA for coverage, and another 500,000 people in Broward County. So just sheer numbers, right? Miami-Dade leads the way. When you think about that number too, it's not just how big that number is. Over half of those individuals actually fall below 138% of the poverty level. And we live in a state that hasn't expanded Medicaid, which would have been kind of a safety net, right? Especially in this situation. But for years now, the state has refused to take up that opportunity. And so as people now see experience the sticker shock and realize just how expensive their plans are, I think you're going to have a fair amount of people who do what they can, like the story you highlighted at the start, who are going to bend themselves in every way possible to keep their coverage because of how much it means to them. But there are going to be so many people who just can't afford coverage whatsoever. And what you get as a result of that is this higher emergency room use, higher uncompensated care costs, And yeah, just in terms of sheer numbers, Miami-Dade is going to feel that more than other places.
And it's still high in Broward County and Palm Beach County as well.
Absolutely.
We mentioned earlier some organizations that are mobilizing food relief in preparation for SNAP cuts, but handing out food seems a whole lot easier to do than handing out healthcare. What kind of resources are available to those who may soon be unable to afford their insurance?
You know, the advice we're giving folks is first to make a list of your priorities, right? To decide what it is that matters most to you in terms of your healthcare. If that's providers that you're, you know, dead set on holding on to, or medications that you need, or just, yeah, services, types of healthcare that you're like looking for. But once you've decided those priorities, because things have shifted so much in terms of cost, but actually also the makeup of the plans, we're encouraging people to just shop early, because that'll give you the time and space you need to try to make a plan, to try to look into resources or other opportunities that may exist. But then finally, just connecting to a trusted resource to actually navigate what healthcare options exist. We've been pointing people to the Covering Florida Navigators, who you can find at coveringflorida.org. They're a nonprofit organization run out of USF, and they just help people with free, unbiased advice to find the best healthcare solutions for them. So we just encourage people to make your list of priorities, shop early to see what the options are, but also rely on people who know the system and can help you get the most out of it. The last thing I'll say about the navigators is often it's not just their expertise isn't just in the ACA. They very often know about other community resources that you might be able to plug into. But I hate to say that the hard truth is just sometimes there aren't enough options for people. And yeah, that's why we have the emergency room usage rates that we do.
And you mentioned those emergency usage rates are going to be more expensive, not just for the person undertaking them, but for people taxpayers who will foot some of that bill.
Absolutely. That's the bigger lesson here in everything that's happening in the world right now. I think we lose sight of the fact that we're all connected, that regardless of how we feel about things, even if you take the most selfish approach, you would have to consider the fact that everything we do impacts everyone else. Part of what's driving this huge increase, one-year increase in the health insurance rates, is actually, if you read the insurer's justifications for it, they point to the fact that because we don't have the enhanced premium tax credits, they're expecting 1 million people to drop coverage. But they're expecting specifically those who are healthiest to drop coverage, right? Meaning those who are left over end up paying a much higher rate for health insurance just because that's how risk pools work. But yeah, at the same time, those prices go up for everyone, not just those in the marketplace. And so there really is an incentive to making sure that everyone remains in coverage in one way or another.
Well, thank you. Congresswoman Sheila Sherfalus McCormick represents Florida's 20th district, and Scott Darius is the executive vice president of Florida Voices for Health. Thank you both so much for joining us for this conversation. Still to come, we get an update on the relief efforts in the aftermath of Hurricane Melissa in the Caribbean. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Carlton Gillespie. Tim Padgett is out this week. Hurricane Melissa swept through much of the Caribbean this week and left a trail of devastation in its wake. One of the strongest hurricanes ever recorded, Melissa made landfall in western Jamaica as a Category 5 storm with 185 mile-per-hour wind speeds on Tuesday before hitting Haiti, eastern Cuba, and the Bahamas thereafter. Here's how Dennis Zulu, UN resident coordinator in Jamaica, described the aftermath. And we're having a bit of technical difficulty with Mr. Zulu, but we will hear from him in a moment if we can get him.
There's been tremendous unprecedented devastation of infrastructure, of property, roads, network, connectivity, energy has been lost across its path. But what is very unique is that the impact of Melissa, though very dire in this area, has actually spread across the country.
So far, 50 people have been confirmed to have died across the Caribbean, with scores more still missing. Some forecasters are estimating the damages to total between $2 and $8 billion. And it's left the Caribbean community in South Florida waiting with bated breath as the full picture of the devastation became clearer in the wake of the storm. Here's Lauderhill Commissioner John Hodgson, who has family in hard-hit Trelawney Parish.
I spoke to my siblings the night before the hurricane, but I've not heard from them. I don't know. Jamaicans are very resilient, but I have seen pictures of the damage, and this is something totally different.
Today, we check in on the recovery effort both in the Caribbean and efforts to mobilize aid stateside. Do you have family in the Caribbean affected by Hurricane Melissa, or are you looking to get involved in the recovery effort? Give us a call at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining us on the roundup is Marlon Hill, lead volunteer mobilizer of South Florida Caribbean Strong. Marlon, great to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me on the roundup. Thank you so much.
Marlon, do you have an idea of what conditions are like on the ground in Jamaica? What is the mood like now that the storm has passed and the full scale of the recovery effort has revealed itself?
Well, Melissa has certainly left her mark, not only on Jamaica, but on Haiti and Dominican Republic, eastern part of Cuba and the Bahamas and Bermuda last night. When you think of Melissa and the conditions, I want you to think of the aftermath of Hurricane Andrew, the aftermath of Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico and Antigua, the aftermath of the hurricane in Ivan in Grenada. That's exactly what the conditions are like right now in western part of Jamaica. So there's one Jamaica, one resilient people, but two different lived experiences, especially in the seven parishes that are on the western side of the island, and which is the heart of our agricultural industry and tourism economy. So it's going to be a long road ahead. The U.S. government search and rescue landed yesterday. They're heading to the western part of the island, and resources and relief items are being mobilized right here in South Florida with partners like Global Empowerment Mission and Food for the Poor. So we know exactly what to do because we have the same lived experience here in Florida. And so we're doing the work.
And one thing I appreciate you mentioning there, I think we have spent a lot of time in discussing Melissa in this story. We spent a lot of time, and rightfully so, on Jamaica. They took easily the strongest blow from the storm. But this really was a pan-Caribbean event, right? Effects were felt in Cuba, Haiti, the Bahamas, and Turks and Caicos. What are the logistical challenges you face now to make sure that aid reaches all these places in the appropriate measure?
Our mission with Caribbean Strong and Global Empowerment Mission is to get the most aid to the most people in the most efficient way at the least cost. So what we're asking our partners and friends, especially and our family members who listen to WLRN, is to focus on that. How can you help? We need the money for transportation costs and other costs to get the items down. Relief workers have to be transported. The items have to be packaged with boxes. So that costs money. So we certainly want folks to support our Caribbean Strong Relief Fund that's set up at the Miami Foundation to support our efforts. One thing that we have done this time around, we have populated the emergency relief items that we have received from ODPEM, which is Jamaica's FEMA, onto an Amazon list. So we have a link. So if you are unable from wherever you are, just go to SFL Caribbean Strong on our Facebook or Instagram, purchase the items, and then you deliver the items to the warehouse where the volunteers are there right now, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. every day. We'll be there tomorrow, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. And we'll also be there 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. And we're asking the volunteers to bring those items, canned protein, hygiene items, toothpaste, toothbrush, shower gel, protein bars. You know, you have people right now that are living without a roof, that are living without the essential items. And it's a humanitarian event, actually, of the likes of Andrew, Ivan, Dorian, all the same. But this one was the most historic hurricane to come from the Atlantic Ocean. And that hit Jamaica and these other countries last week.
And hit them directly. You mentioned some ways that people can give to your organization through the Amazon list. You know, it is Friday. People are getting their paychecks today if they have the extra money to support you. But say someone doesn't have the money, but they have the time. How can people get involved in the work you're doing?
We in the congresswoman just said that we're living in very tough times, and we hope that the man-made disaster by our elected officials with this shutdown will not continue to give us the hardship to help each other, right? Natural disasters don't have any bearing on who's impacted. And we know this quite well right here in South Florida with Irma and Wilma. And so if anyone is listening through the near shot of earshot of these Roundup airwaves, please, we need your help. We need your monies. It's tax deductible. You can go to the Miami Foundation Caribbean Strong Relief Fund. You can go directly to GEM at gem.org. It doesn't matter how small. Some, if let's say you have a student that wants to give $10, that's going to go a long way. If you want to purchase the items, just go to SFL Caribbean Strong. You can go to my social media as well. The link is there. And if you definitely don't have the resources, come and give us some time, give us an hour, or organize your church or self-organize your community organization, and then we will come to you and pick up the relief items.
And the other thing people are missing, if, as we heard from Commissioner Hodgson in Lauderhill, is their community or their family members. You know, much of the island lost power during the storm, and people have not been able to contact their family members or their friends who are still on the island. What do you know about the efforts to reestablish that connectivity?
Well, we're grateful for Starlink for extending the internet usage up until November. We're grateful for that. The telecommunications companies on the island are doing their best to kind of get service up, whether it's Digicel, Flow, et cetera. We're monitoring that. The airports opened yesterday in Kingston, the international airports, relief items, the Caribbean Strong and GEM. Our two planes arrived yesterday, and the trucks with the supplies are heading to Southwest Jamaica right now to deliver relief directly to the folks. So it's moving, right? We have a process. A very efficient process of getting relief directly to the people that need it. If you have a Jamaican friend, a Jamaican coworker, somebody that you do business with, or you're an in-law, I think today we're going to adopt the day as Hug a Jamaican Day, or also Hug a Haitian or someone from the Dominican Republic. Anyone impacted by Melissa needs your support. We need a hug. We need some empathy. We need some compassion. And if you have the resources anywhere in your bank account on this payday before the Thanksgiving season, we ask you to think about Jamaica.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Carlton Gillespie. I'm speaking with Marlon Hill, lead volunteer mobilizer of South Florida Caribbean Strong, about the recovery efforts underway in the aftermath of Hurricane Melissa. If you want to be part of this conversation or share your story, you can call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. And as a reminder, if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. Marlon, the physical recovery in Jamaica will take time, but I want to talk to you now about the financial recovery of the island. Jamaica actually has a very sophisticated, multi-layered financial system in place to handle catastrophes like this one. But with some estimating the damages into the billions of dollars, even with this plan in place, how well situated is Jamaica to handle itself financially?
You know, those financial decisions were pragmatic and very, very prudent and practical. We're grateful for the government thinking of having the policy of the catastrophe bond. But this is going to really take an Herculean effort. It's going to be almost like a Marshall Plan investment. And we want the listeners to also think about this, not just as a donation of charity per se, but also think about it as an opportunity to invest in a new Jamaica, invest in the rebuilding of Jamaica. Even though the disasters takes away so much from us, roofs, buildings, hospitals, historic cultural assets and churches, even lives. We have to move on. Life, as they say, is always life thing, right? So, but Jamaica is going to need your investment. You may be a company, you may have or a professional that may want to contribute your services at a discount, right? There's going to be the relief effort, there's going to be the recovery effort, and there's going to be the rebuilding effort. And we did the same thing here with Andrew. Puerto Rico did the same thing with Maria. Grenada had to do the same thing with Ivan. And last year we escaped Beryl early in the season, and that caused billions of damage. But this one was a direct hit on 7% primary parishes that are the heart of Jamaica's economy. And it's not only going to take Jamaicans to rebuild, we're going to need a lot of support from across the world. And we're hoping that our friends and family will heed the call over the next few weeks and the next months, actually, maybe even a couple of years, to really fully recover from the impact of Melissa.
And it's a reminder that a lot of other countries that were impacted by Melissa don't have that kind of financial foresight in place and will still be grappling with these impacts. You know, Marlon, in many ways, it seems that Melissa is the growing threat of climate change made manifest, especially to island nations like the ones in the Caribbean. As stronger storms become more frequent, the Caribbean keeps feeling the brunt of these changes, even though they contribute proportionately very little to climate change. You've mentioned that, quote, Marshall Plan to mitigate these kind of impacts. Can you walk us through what that plan would look like?
Well, what that would look like is, you know, CARICOM, which is now led by Prime Minister Holness from Jamaica, and Mia Motley from Barbados. She was the previous prime minister, who has spoken many times on the United Nations floor about this issue. We in the Caribbean region, irrespective of the language or the food that we eat, you know, we're going to need to really rethink what our place is in this world if the world doesn't think about us, right? And so I think we will have to change the narrative of waiting for an investment or waiting for policy changes and really take charge of this, especially with us being such a important part of the fabric of America, right? And it's unfair for us as island nations or persons of Caribbean descent to bear this burden. And this burden is not just the burden of our region, it's also the burden of America. We are just 100 miles away. We're 200 miles away. We are in cities here in South Florida. We are in your supermarkets. We are in your hospitals caring for your grandparents. We are in your doctor's offices. We are in your law offices like myself. You know, so we're not just a passing thought. We are part of the fabric of America, and we're deserving, I think, of the consideration for policies that mutually impact us, especially with Florida being an extension of the Caribbean region.
And I want to bring us back here to Haiti, an island that was not directly hit by Melissa, but is feeling some of the strongest effect. The higher death counts are coming from Haiti. Their lack of infrastructure leading up to the storm has caused things to be much worse there. What are you working on as far as aid distribution to the to Haiti?
You know, Global Empowerment Mission was founded from the Haiti earthquake in 2010. So we certainly understand the gravity and the impact of these storms. They're not singular, they're plural, right? So the resources that we're raising is not singularly meant for Jamaica. Mm-hmm. We are working with partners in these other countries to see how we can get relief there as well. You have the historic city of Jacmel on the southwestern part of Haiti that's impacted. Our friends over in Santo Domingo, they are also impacted in the Dominican Republic. And irrespective of our relationship with Cuba, we know that our extended family members and friends in Santiago, Cuba, they are also impacted as well, along with the southeastern part of the Bahamas, Turks and Caicos, and then Bermuda. We're still assessing the damage, and we will try to respond accordingly. But certainly, I don't think any of the listeners need to wait for that damage assessment to understand what the call to action is.
Well, Marlon, we really appreciate your time. And if you'd like to give the link again where people can support your cause or volunteer.
Please, you know, go to the social media, SFL Caribbean Strong on Instagram and Facebook. You can also go to sflcaribbeanstrong.org. That's where we are mobilizing. Most of us are here in South Florida, but we have friends all across the region. And you can also go to gem.org and give directly there. The link is in our bios to purchase supplies directly and deliver to the warehouse. And then if you want to volunteer, come out. We're already oversubscribed with hundreds of people for the weekend.
Thank you, Marlon. It's a Hollywood homecoming for the film Canvas and its director. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Carlton Gillespie. The 2006 film Canvas is a perfect Hollywood movie. No, not that Hollywood, our Hollywood, the one here in Broward County. The movie was filmed all across the city and some other South Florida locations and directed by Joseph Greco. He's a Hollywood native and a graduate of Hollywood Hills High School. Canvas is a deeply personal film. Inspired by Greco's childhood, it tells the story of a family that grapples with a mother's worsening schizophrenia, told on a backdrop of locations that'll be familiar to many South Florida watchers. And now the movie is coming home. The city of Hollywood, as part of their 100th anniversary celebration, is hosting a free screening of Canvas and a Q&A this Saturday at Hollywood Cinema Paradiso. But before that, here with the A's to all of our Q's is the director, Joseph Greco. Joseph, welcome to the South Florida Roundup.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be on.
I'd like to start with this event coming up. You grew up in Hollywood, as we mentioned, and began making films here before you moved to that other Hollywood over on the West Coast. What does this mean to you, being able to come back and show this movie in particular in your hometown as the city celebrates its 100th anniversary?
Well, it is deeply meaningful. And as you said, it is a very personal story. I grew up with a parent living with mental illness. And my way of sort of sublimating all of that angst and trauma was a creative outlet, you know, making the movie, writing it, and ultimately directing it. And to be able to bring that story back to Hollywood, where I grew up, is very personal. So much of the story originated there. And, you know, art, it really does allow us to, I think, help us find meaning in otherwise difficult situations.
And it's interesting to me you mention art as this creative outlet to get out some of that angst you were feeling. That's evident in the film. Each of our main characters, the father builds a boat, the son takes up sewing, and the mother manages her mental illness through painting. How much of that is bleeding through from your personal experiences?
Oh, absolutely. And I didn't really intend or know at the time when I was writing it that there were these connections, but that's exactly what happens. And art really is, I think, a healing act. And all three of the characters, you know, Marcia Gay Harden plays a character inspired by my own mother, and my mother would paint and do artwork when I was young. And my father built three sailboats, and the movie is about one of those boats. And I had my own art as a kid. And so, you know, that was very important to me. And actually, in making the film, I asked, there's a wonderful organization in Fort Lauderdale called Nine Muses. And it's a peer-run organization that actually allows people who are living with a mental illness or struggling with substance abuse to actually come in and use art therapy. And so all the artwork created by the character Marcia Gay Harden in the movie, Mary, she plays a character named Mary, is actually created by these artists at Nine Muses. And they're going to actually have an exhibit on display at the Cinema Paradiso. So I'm really excited to bring them back and honor them and really, you know, help tell that story for those who might be struggling, you know, that there's always a way through. And art really can help us sublimate something and hopefully find something meaningful out of that situation.
And what was it like, I mean, working with, you know, organizations like local organizations like that and taking some of these places that kind of shaped you as you grew up and putting them into the film? What does that mean for you as a filmmaker and as a Hollywood native?
Oh, it was enormously gratifying. And, you know, it almost didn't happen because there was a time where we were thinking of we might shoot in New Jersey because it would be closer to our actors. And then at one point, we might shoot in Miami because that was where some of my producers had their offices. But I couldn't find the locations that we needed. You know, we needed not just a house, but the places where I went sailing with my father, all of those things were really important. And I realized very quickly that it made more sense to film down in Hollywood. It's really a love letter, not just to my parents and to my experience, but I think to hopefully the city. And preserving these places that are so meaningful to me and I think to so many others.
Well, as a Broward County native, I can tell you one of the great joys of watching this film was clocking all of the local landmarks and neighborhoods that I recognized. And I will say, seeing the Orange Bowl still standing in the film's opening sequence did twinge my heartstrings a little bit, but plenty of other locations are very much still there. What are the differences you see between the Hollywood in your film that was almost a snapshot of 20 years ago and Hollywood today?
That's a great question. I think, you know, the soul of Hollywood is still very much there. I like to say it's a small beach town, but it has grown up a lot. I mean, you know, on the beach, Hollywood Beach has grown up. There's a lot more hotels, a lot bigger hotels than when I was a kid. And some of the places that I would go to to eat. You know, some of the restaurants are no longer there, but there are a lot of places that are still there. And I think, you know, ultimately the place, I think, is informed by the people and the cultures. And I'm a firm believer that authentic sense of place is a real character in any movie.
Do you have a greater appreciation for this film now that Florida no longer has a statewide incentive to film in Florida, and films like Canvas that have that really deeply personal sense of place, they just aren't made here in this state anymore?
Yes, it's true. And it is unfortunate that there isn't a real state incentive, because I think it's not just an artistic issue or an arts conversation. It's also, I think, a small business conversation, because it really is an investment in community. And there are so many wonderful stories. You guys know this, you profile so many wonderful artists. I do think there are some people up in Tallahassee who recognize this. And then there's, you know, on a local level, Sandy Leiterman and her team, the Broward Film Commission, they are so passionate and they do have an incentive. So I do think there is support. As artists, I think we just have to keep going. And my hope is to bring the next one that I'm working on back to Fort Lauderdale. It's another story inspired by true events. And I'm going to keep pushing and try and find a way to make it happen.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Carlton Gillespie. I'm speaking with Joseph Greco, a Hollywood native and director of the film Canvas, about the upcoming free showing of his film in Hollywood to celebrate their 100th anniversary. Well, another famous South Florida event that certainly impacted my young life and impacted filming, it didn't make it into the movie, but certainly played a role in the production, was Hurricane Wilma. Can you tell us what happened with Hurricane Wilma during the filming of this movie?
Yeah, you know, I mentioned briefly that we almost shot in New Jersey, and Joey Pants, Joe Pantoliano, who plays John, the father in the movie, inspired by my own father, he said, well, look, we're only available at this time in October. And I said, well, okay, well, if we shoot in Florida, unfortunately, that's hurricane season. And Joey said, oh, don't worry, we'll be okay. And, you know, I guess lesson learned, we actually got hit by 3 hurricanes. We got hit by Katrina and Rita during pre-production and prep. And then our third week of shooting, we did get a direct hit from Wilma on my mother's birthday, no less. It was definitely a challenge, but again, the community really rallied. And one of my producers told me, just keep shooting. And my other producers were so supportive. We just found a way, and we hooked up the generator to a gas station there in Hollywood and got everyone gas and a hot meal. And we said, look, you know, we understand you want to go home to your families. And we put our cast on planes immediately when we knew there was any chance of danger, but they flew back and we finished the film. And you know, we were filming the scene. There's a scene in the movie where Marcia Gay Harden's character is out in the rain suffering with a debilitating delusion.
Right.
And when our rain towers would turn off, the fake rain that we needed for the scene, the real rain from the outer bands of Wilma was already starting to hit Hollywood. And it was very surreal. And, you know, we filmed all night. She got on a plane at 6 a.m. and then we were down for 2 or 3 days. But, you know, by the grace of God, and I had such a wonderful crew. And some of those crew members and producers will join me at the Q&A on Saturday, the 1st, to talk about this. And I think looking back, it wasn't fun at the time, but looking back, we all have our war stories, and we were able to finish the film. And again, it's like making lemonade out of lemons. And some of the critical scenes in the movie had yet to be filmed, including the sailing scene on North Lake. You know, you do what you have to do as an artist, as a filmmaker. But yeah, it was definitely not fun while it was happening.
I think a lot of South Floridians especially can relate to that hurricane experience. It wasn't fun when it was happening, but we all have our war stories that we like to swap whenever
Yes. The
next one is rolling around, don't we?
Absolutely. And hopefully we're a little more prepared for the next one.
I'd like to take a little deeper look into the film now. Canvas tells the story of a boy and his father that's navigating this difficult and really heartbreaking journey of living with a mom and a wife with schizophrenia. Can you tell our listeners more specifically, you've touched on it a little bit, but how your childhood inspired this film and your reflection on this end result almost 20 years after its debut as it's having its homecoming screening?
When I was a child, I was very shy, and my mother had these debilitating delusions, and it got so bad that she had to be hospitalized in Florida. It's called the Baker Act, and she was a danger to herself and others, and it was, you know, unfortunately, it needed to be done. And it was a horrible, harrowing ordeal. My father just, he longed to connect with something. And again, it was about that sort of trying to make something, you know, create something artistic. So he just started building a boat in the backyard. And actually it started in the front yard. I think there were people who complained. And so he was undaunted. He moved it to the backyard, which is part of the story of the movie.
Right.
And, you know, I always remember that time in my life because, and it was a way for me, I think, to deal with an intractable issue and try and, again, find meaning in it. I couldn't even talk about this when I was in college, you know, and I had my own journey with therapy and making the film was extraordinarily cathartic. And now, you know, here we are almost 20 years later, the movie's is going to be celebrating its 20th anniversary. It's amazing because I didn't realize I had PTSD from this whole ordeal. But it's nice to be able to frame it. And my mother, you know, loves the film, and my father was able to see it before he passed away. So there's so much I'm grateful for, but it's deeply personal. And I didn't know that there were others, so many others, who have a similar story of trauma as a child or mental illness. And so I would say to those who are living with this is there is hope. You know, there are wonderful organizations like Mental Health America and National Alliance for Mental Illness that offer support. And they've rallied to support the film when it came out and are huge advocates. So I think it's all about connection. And I think that community really has to come together. Hopefully that's something that people take away from watching the movie.
And you touch on something I think very important there to the film at the end. You know, we often talk about how well does a movie, you know, hold up? And I think there are films, even modern films, that don't hold up, especially when it comes to their portrayals of mental illnesses. This film's depiction of schizophrenia has been praised for its authenticity and its tenderness. Why is that representation so important to you? Not just to dispel myths about the disease, but also encourage that dialogue about it.
Yeah, I agree. And thank you for that. That's something I'm very proud of. And I had a wonderful cast. You know, Marcia Gay Harden is such a fantastic actress. And she and Joey, both, Joe Pantoliano, did a lot of research. They actually went to a wonderful organization in New York called the Fountain House. It's a clubhouse model, peer-run group. And she really wanted to do this justice. And you're right, there's a lot of portrayals of mental illness in movies and television that isn't quite authentic, or they romanticize it. I just wanted to tell my story as it was true to what I knew. And there is a lot of stigma around mental illness still. I mean, when we made the movie, we were one of the first stories, I think, to really try and not romanticize it and not draw on too much of the dramatic tricks. You know, this is a movie really just about a family. There's no outside glamorous element to it. It's just a family trying to deal with this. Now, you know, 20 years later, there is a lot more empathy towards folks who are dealing with this, and people are a lot more comfortable talking about it. I'm deeply honored to have this chance to bring it back, and I hope that those who do see it and continue to see it will find some solace and seeing that they're not alone.
You have described this film as, quote, a love letter to your parents. You mentioned that both of them got a chance to see it. Do you remember their reactions to seeing the movie?
This is a little story. When I was making the film, I intentionally didn't share too much with my parents because I didn't want to have their voices in my head, I guess figuratively, not literally. But I wanted to just tell my story as it was authentic to me. But when it was finished and before we locked picture, I did play the movie for my mother on a DVD. I came to her home and I was nervous. After I played it, she looked at me with tears in her eyes and she loved it. And that meant so much. Sometimes when my mother is having a difficult day and she still lives with this illness, you know, we're able to talk about the movie and talk about, you know, you remember when Marcia was acting that way, you know, and it kind of, it's a nice shorthand for her to remember, okay, yeah, I do have this issue. It's not easy, for sure, but yeah, I'm very happy that my parents enjoyed the film.
Joseph Greco is the director of Canvas. The free community screening celebrating 100 years of the city of Hollywood will take place tomorrow at 7:30 p.m. at Hollywood Cinema Paradiso. Joseph, it's a wonderful film. Thank you for sharing it with us, and thank you so much for joining the roundup.
Thank you.
Finally, on the roundup, Haitians across South Florida will honor Native tradition and spirituality in celebration of their annual Festival of the Dead. WLRN's Wilkin Brutus has more.
Tafami Soleil's song Racine, which means roots, captures the spirit of Fête Gidée, Haiti's Festival of the Dead, which is observed annually November 1st and 2nd. And the tradition blends Vodou and Catholic influences to honor ancestors and Lakou, which means the land and community. Here's Mi Soleil.
We need to find ways to stay connected to our roots because this is what we are. This is who we are. We can be our own Lakou anywhere in the world.
The festival, hosted by Haitian musician Nati Dread Aiti, features performances by jazz trumpeter Jean Caz, Afro-electronica artist Val Genti, and the band Rara Nu. The festival also educates Haitians who feel disconnected from the history of Fête Gidée. Mi Soleil says traditional Haitian spirituality is both the creative heart and foundation of the celebration. I'm Wilkin Brutus in Palm Beach County.
That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance by Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's Vice President of News. The Vice President of Radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Carlton Gillespie. Have a great weekend, and thank you for listening.
WLRN.